I think we all have experienced defense attorneys who will say and do anything to get their client off. And this sounds like one of those types.
Any attorney always advises their client to write attorney-client protected material so that anybody whose straying eyes might see it will know that this is protected material.
So he acknowledged in this post-arrest statement to the police that he had dumped gasoline onto his girlfriend.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, lockdowns are lifting. We're still apart. I start to wonder whether you have coordinated with the governors of California and Georgia
to ensure that continues. My secret is out, Francie. Wow, I thought I had that covered pretty well with that whole thing going on, but whatever, I guess not. However, we are fortunate to have a very special guest.
Thank you, Jim. This is Kay Winfrey speaking to you from my dining room. Like most people, I am still at home. I am in Rockville, Maryland, but it's really nice to be able to talk to somebody other than, well, nobody. I talk to nobody these days, so I'm pretty excited about being on the show today.
So the bar basically was very,
very
low.
Well, I didn't mean it that
very
way,
low.
But, you know, yeah.
That's what I heard. Kate's sitting right in with us, although I don't know. I feel like she's on your side because I'm lovely to talk to ordinarily.
Yes, actually, I was going to say, please, Jim, don't talk about crazy conspiracy theories because I just... Everybody has those these days. So.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well,
talk about something different, Kay, because your experience is, I guess I used to think I had sort of the full package as a former state and federal prosecutor, but you've got the trifecta because you were a state, federal, and you were an assistant attorney general.
Yes. Chief Deputy Attorney General for the state of Maryland, actually.
You make me look bad, Jim.
Well,
no, not really,
again,
no.
Remember we were talking about low bars?
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. But we are, just so our listeners are aware, we are aware that there are very difficult and horrible things happening in the world right now. But we're trying to be a little lighter and hopefully give our listeners a little bit of a respite from the difficulties that we're all going through at this point. So with that in mind, okay, tell us where you were in your career when this particular case that you want to talk to us about happened.
Sure. I'd like to be able to say, going back to what you just said, Jim, that this is a lighter moment. It's lighter only in the sense that it happened almost 10 years ago, and it's not something any of the listeners hopefully will have experienced. And so it's old news, but no less painful to those of us who are involved in it. So I became involved in this matter in the end, very end of 2011, 2012. So I was at the very end of my, about another year and a half of my 8 years as Chief Deputy Attorney General for the state of Maryland. And this was the very last homicide case that I tried. In fact, the last case that I tried.
Wow. And what was it that you were doing when you first came into contact with this case?
Okay, so as former chief deputy state's attorney in Montgomery County, I attended monthly meetings on behalf of my boss, the attorney general, of the state's attorneys association. They had monthly meetings where all the state's attorneys could get together and talk about common issues. And since I had been one of them, I attended those meetings. And they always were, there were very interesting, and they had good food. And anyway, I happened to sit next to Dario Broccolino, who was the state's attorney for Howard County, which is adjacent to my county, Montgomery County. And it is probably a toss-up between Montgomery or Howard being the two wealthiest counties in Maryland. And he asked me about a matter that was pending in my office. It was an inquiry that his office had made. They had had a very odd ruling, which I could get into in a minute, an odd ruling from a circuit court judge in Howard County that she had ruled that they had, that the trial team had to recuse themselves from the case. Again, well, I'll get into that in a minute. But
okay, before you go on, this is so interesting. I guess maybe you can explain to our listeners and me, every state seems to call their judges different things. Here in Georgia, we've got state court and superior court, and then you've got the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. Can you explain what you have in Maryland?
Right. So we have four levels. The lowest level are the district court judges, and they are courts of limited jurisdiction. They don't trials. They try minor criminal misdemeanors and civil cases with lower dollar amounts, no jury cases. The next level are the courts of general jurisdiction, the circuit courts. And that's what I was mentioning, a circuit court. And then we have two courts of appeals. The first is our Court of Special Appeals. And then we have the Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in Maryland, akin to what other states have as a Supreme Court.
Okay, great. So you're at this meeting and you are sitting next to a colleague in the Howard State's Attorney's Office, Howard County State's Attorney's
Office. Howard County. He was actually the elected state's attorney. And what he wanted to know was if I knew anything about the inquiry that his office had made. His trial team in this murder case had been ordered by the circuit court judge to recuse or excuse themselves. In other words, they would not be allowed to proceed as the prosecutors in the case.
And that right there is very unusual. I'm not sure I've ever heard of that case.
Very unusual, and the circumstances are unusual. So, and that fits into my involvement later down the line. And the judge had denied a defense motion to recuse the entire Howard County State's Attorney's Office. She said that that wasn't necessary. So their inquiry that had come to the Attorney General's office, to the head of criminal appeals, was, if we don't recuse ourselves, the office, and we proceed, how likely are we, will you defend us on appeal if we get a conviction, and how likely would we be to succeed? And I said, I had not talked to my team about it, but I don't know, I just had this crazy, well, why don't I try it for you? If you don't have somebody else in your office, and just to take the issue off the table, I'll try the case. And his face lit up and he said, would you? And I said, would I? I'd be delighted because I hadn't tried a case for some time. So that was after that meeting. It's probably in November or December of 2011. Then I got involved in the case. So as I say, it's a little bit different than what you've heard from me. I've been sitting in my office in Montgomery County and getting a call from the police. This was when I actually volunteered, really knowing very little about the case.
And probably really knowing very little about the quagmire you were about to step into.
Yeah, but that appealed to me. You know, I didn't really care about that. So we did talk a little further. I had to run it by my boss, the attorney general, but I knew he would not say no. So Howard County let the circuit court know that I was going to be trying the case. And I went upstairs, I guess, to the criminal division. We had a very small office in the attorney general's office doing actual criminal cases, not the appeals, because there's not a lot of original jurisdiction for criminal cases in the AG's office. So I went to a younger prosecutor who had worked for me and my boss when we were in the state's attorney's office and asked her if she would like to try the case with me. For me, that was always something that I like to mentor junior attorneys, and it's always nice to have somebody else's thoughts and somebody else to share the workload and all of it. And she was really excited about it. So her name is Megan Lamarzi, and she and I went ahead and took over the case.
You know, Kay, it's interesting that you say that. It's all about mentoring, but it's also about having a trial partner. You know, there are district attorney's offices, U.S. attorney's offices, and I guess AG's offices who have that ability, that sort of luxury of having enough people so that you can always have a trial partner. But gosh, I would have to say the vast majority of cases that I've tried in my career, I've tried alone with just whoever my agent was or my officer or my detective sitting next to me, because the places where I worked simply didn't have that luxury. They were busy offices with massive caseloads generally. And, you know, murder cases got tried where I prosecuted alone.
Yeah. And it's doable. Obviously, you've done it and you've succeeded. I'm sure there were cases that you wished you'd had somebody sitting by your side to bounce ideas.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody, could you take this witness, please? You know.
Oh, yeah.
So I can understand that. I was fortunate enough in all the murder cases I ever tried to have somebody else as co-counsel. So that was a big advantage.
So this is interesting, Kay, because it's very different from the last few cases that you came on to talk about where you were involved, you know, right from the jump, where you are aware of it when someone has died. But now it's at the point where there's a defense attorney and a trial team being moved to be recused from the case. So obviously someone's under arrest and there's a trial date that is either coming up or is about to be set. So you've got a case right in the middle that you're taking over.
Right. Well, the trial date had been set. It was set for February of the following year, 2012. So we didn't have a lot of time. It was not as complicated as some, not as factually complicated as some murder cases, but there were other challenges and we needed to get on top of that.
Well, awesome. So, okay. So you've agreed to do it. Obviously, there's something that has to be filed to allow you to be admitted into that court to prosecute the case. And tell us then what you did. Obviously, you have to get into the facts and get the case files and tell us all about that process.
Right. So of course that motion was filed by the office. I think we had to sign something that was pretty pro forma and the defense lawyer didn't really have any ability to object. You know, he moved to recuse the whole office and he didn't get that granted, but he got what he wished for. And it's funny because I remember saying, I don't think he's going to be happy with what he got. because I had a lot more experience than most of the lawyers in the Howard County State's Attorney's Office. It sounds like dig me. I don't mean it to sound like that, but I was an unknown to him. So, and sometimes it's better to be underestimated. And I think that happened to him. So as I recall, the next step that we took was to go to the Howard County State's Attorney's Office. So for me, the whole time that I was working this case, I did not go to Baltimore. So Howard County is much closer to where I was living in Montgomery County. And my co-prosecutor actually lives in Howard County. So this was very convenient for her. And we went to the office, we met with the state's attorney, we met with the two former prosecutors, basically for them to say, here are the files, we can't talk to you. And then I found out a little bit more about why they couldn't talk to me. So you'll remember that I said they had been ordered to get out of the case. They had been recused by the circuit court judge.
That's a very, very, very rare thing, obviously.
Very rare thing.
And it doesn't usually happen when they do everything correctly. Am I wrong
here?
You would
say so. It doesn't usually happen, but this happened. They did nothing wrong and they still got bounced out of the case. So here's what happened to make this come about. As you know, and maybe most of our listeners do too, when you're in jail, you have a very low expectation of privacy. Cells can get tossed. They search them for contraband. Things are taken all the time. All of their phone calls are recorded and up for grabs. As a prosecutor, you can, you know, get them all and listen to them. Well, in this case, the jail officials had searched his cell. The man's name is Richard Rodola, and they had searched Rodola's cell and found some papers that they seized, and they could tell that they were about the case, and they were in his handwriting. They turned them over to the state's attorney's office, and there were a lot of ramblings in there, his version of the events, and, you know, just kind of, it was consistent with the defense that he presented at trial. And naturally, when you get statements of the defendant, you're required to turn them over to the defense counsel. Well, this extraordinary man, and I use that in not a, I don't use it as a compliment, took the position that this was attorney-client privileged material because he had directed that these documents had been prepared at his behest, that he had directed his client to write down his version of the offense. And he testified at a hearing to that effect. Well, that either he was a liar on the one hand or completely incompetent on the other hand, because what defense attorney would ever do that?
No, and leave it in a cell. Well, I can tell you what I think. I'll put my money on Kay. And that is that he was a liar, because I think we all have experienced defense attorneys who will say and do anything to get their client off. And this sounds like one of those types, but
right.
I'm just guessing, I'm ahead of you. So keep going.
Right. But before we even get there, any attorney who is communicating in writing to any client and wants it to be protected always advises their client to write attorney client protected material so that anybody whose straying eyes might see it, anybody who's part of the justice system will know that this is protected material.
Why and would leave it there. They right. would have left it alone.
Right. Why would he advise his client to, quote, write down a statement and then not advise him to write attorney-client privilege on it?
Well, the simple answer is, I'm like Francie, I don't believe that he did that. I don't believe that it was privileged. I also suspect that the judge did not believe his testimony, but it's very difficult when you have a lawyer who testifies under oath that this is what they did to come right out. I mean, I've heard judges call police officers liars, but this would have been complicated. He was retained counsel, and I think she simply chose to accept his testimony. And on the basis of that, she found that this trial team had seen privileged materials that they should not have seen, and that it might prejudice his defense at trial. And that's why she kicked the trial team.
Well, and Kay, this is one of those insider secrets. I was talking to some of the guys at our production company about inside trial secrets, things that people don't ever think about or understand what goes on. This is one of those dirty little secrets, I think. If you've got a judge and she believes the defense attorney is lying and she calls him out on it, she has all of a sudden now given that defense attorney a reason to move to recuse the judge out of the case, because then the attorney can say, well, judge, you think I'm a liar. There's no way that you can be unbiased in your rulings while we're in trial in this case. I deserve another judge. I mean, it's one of those games that defense attorneys can actually play and sometimes play successfully. So it sounds to me that what she did was, okay, defense attorney, I really don't have much choice in this, but to say I accept your testimony, so I'm going to dump this trial team, but I refuse to agree to dump the whole office. I mean, that sounds like what she decided to do.
That's what she did. And it's funny that you say that he could have moved to recuse the judge. He didn't have to. I don't know how this came about, but it got reassigned to another judge who what? Oh, but this was beautiful. He was the former state's attorney. And I knew him personally.
Oops. That's a big oops.
Kind of like, be careful what you wish for, you know?
Right.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So that's the backdrop of how they got kicked off the case and how I put my hand up and volunteered to do it. So Megan and I, as I mentioned, we went and met with the trial team. They showed us where we were going to be, which honestly was they're a small office. We literally had what looked like a closet. They had to clean evidence out of it. It was fine. I didn't care. You know, we had two desks, that we had computers, or I guess we brought laptops from the office. We had a window, so that wasn't so bad. And any meeting that we had with witnesses, we met in their very lovely conference room. So it was fine. And I didn't have to drive to Baltimore. So it, and the The police station was literally right across the street from the state's attorney's office. The courthouse was down the road, but when we wanted to talk to our officers, we just walked across the street or they came over to us. So the physical layout was fine. So we began the process. Then the first, after we met with the trial team who said, bye, we can't talk to you, we met with the victim witness coordinator who had the very challenging task of hurting the witnesses. So now I'm going to tell you, if you're ready for it, a little bit about the case and why there were witness challenges. So Mr. Rodola and the victim in the case, Pamela Myers, were on again, off again, boyfriend and girlfriend. They were also heavy drinkers and they were homeless. And there were two eyewitnesses to what happened in this case. And they were a couple, a man and a woman who also were heavy drinkers. And she had been babysitting, if you will, this homeless couple who were the eyewitnesses. Nobody had to babysit the defendant. As I mentioned, he was in jail. And so part of her challenge had been keeping in contact with them. She would have them come into the office. Every time they came into the office, somebody would meet with them and give them a little voucher for food or something. But they were homeless, and that's a real challenge to keep track of people.
Kate, I mean, that's such a great point. It's one of the challenges of being a state prosecutor that is definitely, as a federal prosecutor, rare for something like that to happen. And even when you have to track witnesses, it's just a lot easier. You have a lot more resources. And as a state prosecutor, there's no money to put somebody like that up in a hotel for what could be weeks or months while you're waiting for a case to go to trial. So that's the best that they could do. And it's really impressive that they were able to even track witnesses that were homeless. And that is one of the many challenges of being a prosecutor when you've got victims who are even more disadvantaged than a garden variety murder victim. You've got a victim who's homeless. And so who's going to be the witnesses? Homeless people. It's terribly difficult.
And I hesitate to call them alcoholics, but I think they probably were alcoholics, which makes that doubly challenging. And so, you know, we knew that finding them was going to be difficult. And then they had made inconsistent statements that I had, and I knew that was going to be a challenge. But I want to tell you a little bit about the facts and circumstances of the murder before we get into the trial, if that's okay at this point. So on the day, I believe that it was October 23rd of 2010, there's this, as I mentioned, Howard County is pretty wealthy, but there is a pocket of homeless people in Howard County, just as there are virtually everywhere in this country. And these folks lived out in the woods. They had tents and they had, you know, a generator. Everything they had was in these tents. And somehow they always found enough money to put together for vodka or whatever they were drinking. And so on this day, all four of them had been drinking heavily. And somehow Pam and Rodola got into an argument and they were all sitting around in lawn chairs. And she made a phone call to moments before this happened to a friend of hers. She's on a cell phone. And she said, oh my God, he's gonna burn me. And he had doused her with gasoline that they kept to run their generator. And then he got, I know it's horrible, it's just horrifying. He got a big lighter and lit her on fire. And so all of them were trying to put the fire out, which they ultimately did. She was sitting in a lawn chair at the time that he lit the gasoline, so that she had 52% of her body was burned, but it was primarily from the waist down.
What a horrifying death.
Well, it didn't happen for another 3 weeks. After many surgeries and the kinds of surgeries that people who have been so grievously burned undergo are beyond description. She was in a medically induced coma for most of the time. I don't think anybody really knows whether she was conscious at all. That doesn't mean that you don't experience pain. And she was taken to Johns Hopkins, and that's one of the best burn unit, one of the best hospitals, of course, in the country, if not the world, with a very good burn unit. But they were not able to save her life, and she died about 3 weeks after, in November of 2010, about 3 weeks after the defendant set her on fire.
Kay, I have a question. Did you accept this case without knowing all these facts? I mean, did you volunteer for this case without knowing all these facts? For example, did you know that the victim and the witnesses were homeless?
You know, at this point, Francie, I don't remember, but I'm pretty sure that Dario didn't tell me anything other than it was a murder murder case and that his trial team had been recused and wanting to know what our office, what position our office would take if they stayed with the case.
Well, kudos to you either way, Kay, because, you know, listen, I'm thinking about this case as a prosecutor and just remembering there are lots of cases where you've got bad evidence and bad witnesses, and that usually results in a bad result unless you can get a plea. I mean, I cannot wait to hear how the trial went. But anyway, sorry, keep going. So you've got the victim who was lit on fire by her sort of on again, off again boyfriend and who died 3 weeks later.
Yeah. So after that initial meeting, we started going through the boxes. I think initially we probably, one of the first people that we met with was the lead homicide detective who, he was not good. He was a very nice person. And we didn't realize how not good he was until midway through trial prep, and there were some things that he had forgotten to document. And we all know what kind of problems that poses when things are not documented as they happen. And I knew immediately we're going to have to do a workaround and find a way not to call him as a witness. And we did. And then we started to meet with other witnesses. We had DNA evidence, and the DNA in this case had been sent to, for some reason, they had not sent it to the state police lab in Baltimore. They had outsourced it to a place in Texas. And each piece of the, there were different pieces of evidence. And instead of it all being done by one person, there were four different DNA technicians who were involved in the process of extracting the DNA and doing the replication. We had only one person who could provide the results. We had to call five witnesses because he would not stipulate to anything in the DNA.
Wow.
So all of those people, he wouldn't stipulate to anything. He wouldn't, this is the first time it's ever happened to me in any kind of case that you couldn't get one single stipulation. He would not stipulate to the chain of custody of the body. So we had to call the man who went to Johns Hopkins and delivered her to the morgue. Where they, the medical examiner's office, where
I mean,
they.
What a waste. I mean, that's one of those things. There's just no argument to be made in that chain of custody. And it's just such a waste. It was so, I think it's one of the reasons that I left the Department of Justice when I left, because I had finally had enough after 16 years. I'd finally had enough of stupid defense motions and having to just, you know, answer. You've got to sign Miranda form and you still have to have a hearing and write a brief. When you have a signed Miranda form, why are we wasting time on this sort of stuff? So that's so frustrating, Kay.
Yeah, well, we've all had cases in which the defense attorneys are literally using every single opportunity at communication as an argument, as a defense tactic, as a way to make it more difficult for the prosecutor in hopes that eventually the good prosecutors will go away, and even Francie would.
Right. And the problem with that, well, you know, I had practiced in D.C. where if they couldn't beat you on the facts of the law, they went after you personally. So I was used to that kind of tactic. And he used some of that here. I wasn't. That didn't. And, you know, by this time, I'm older now, but I wasn't young then, you know. So that didn't bother me. But he was just such a, I have a lot of words, but he was a not nice person. Oh. And
by the way, everyone, I just want our listeners to know I haven't fallen asleep or had a heart attack. In case you're wondering why I didn't defend myself when Jim just insulted me, I did notice, but I'm so engrossed in Kay's tale that I just let it slide.
Okay, I thought maybe you were just in a self-induced coma.
Maybe
no
I couldn't.
No such luck, Jim.
So, by the way, he did, at the trial, he did, in his closing argument, berate me for calling those witnesses. Look at that waste of money. Why, you know?
What?
Anyway, yeah.
Why did they call
those people from Texas? They didn't add anything. I didn't ask them a single question. Why did they do that?
What a jerk. Or my favorite new word, asshat. I know it's not really new, but it's, you know, I haven't really used it. So I'm going to use it now and call him an asshat.
He was.
Were you able to mention that in your rebuttal closing?
I did, and I think what I said was that, you know, unless the parties agree that a witness isn't necessary, we have to to call everybody to prove our case. We have to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt. So I didn't say he didn't agree. I just kind of, you know, turned it on to the burden.
You're in an impossible position there, because if you had started arguing about what he did or didn't agree to, you know what would have been his next argument. And that would have been your burden shifting and a request for a mistrial. So you have to, that's the one of the most frustrating things about being a prosecutor. People think it's fair to both sides, and it's really not. And I get it. It has to be super fair to the defendant, because you are talking about taking someone's liberty, or in death penalty cases, taking someone's life. So I understand it, but it's frustrating when you're a prosecutor and you have to deal with that.
It can be. So as we went into our trial preparation, we called all these witnesses, some people like the gentleman who transported the body to the medical examiner's office. I probably just talked to him on the phone, you know, and we met with, because of statements that Rodola had made post-arrest that had been litigated before Megan and I got in the case. So we knew we weren't going to use them because it was an accident, was his explanation. And, you know, I know there's a lot of people who think if a defendant makes statements post-arrest, wow, you got to use them. Well, we knew we weren't going to, because if we had put those in evidence, then he wouldn't have had to testify.
Wait. Okay. So this is super interesting. So post-arrest, he made statements. So he made statements to the police in an interrogation or an interview or whatever it was, where he said that his on-again, off-again girlfriend got accidentally doused with gasoline and lit on fire.
Well, it was clumsy, but not quite as bad as that. So he acknowledged in this post-arrest statement to the police that he had dumped gasoline onto his girlfriend, but he said he didn't intend to light her on fire, and that when he flicked the lighter on, he wasn't close to her, and it wasn't close enough in his view to light the gasoline, and it just sort of spontaneously did it, and he never meant to hurt her, never meant to set her on fire, never meant to injure her. He loved her, you know.
Yeah.
So we knew that was going to be his defense.
Well, that and now, remember when you said, we were talking earlier about the intelligence of the defense attorney and how anybody who would advise his client to write out his story should always put the disclaimer on the top that this is attorney-client protected. But a defense attorney that would allow that defense, I mean, now I understand. He probably did tell the guy, write out statements. Go ahead. Because this guy has to be a fool.
Well, the guy is a fool, but I still think he's a lying fool.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, I don't know what was in the letters or the papers that were seized from the jail, because I could never see them. But I do know that he continued to tell that story. His mother called him at the jail, and I listened to dozens of those calls, and some of them didn't have anything to do with the offense, but in others he would tell the same story. So we fully expected that, we had to be prepared for that as a potential defense. And he maintained that, I don't remember what the distance was, but he was some distance from her gasoline-soaked body when he lit the lighter, flicked the lighter on.
Wow, okay, this is really, really compelling, but we've kind of run out of time, and we can't wait to hear what happens at this trial, because it sounds like so many things are conspiring to make this a very interesting trial.
As indeed it was. And so what is my incentive to come back and tell you the rest of the tale?
You get to see my beautiful face and listen to Francie's voice.
Hey, Jim, what's with the insults? I put on makeup today.
She looks lovely, actually. I was going to say,
I was kind of saying it the opposite. You get to actually see Francie's beautiful face and listen to my beautiful voice.
You both have beautiful voices. That's probably you having the kind of jobs that you have. And you're both beautiful.
Kay's the best.
Are you? So we'll have to wait to hear the rest of the story. Until next time, signing off on Best Case, Worst Case. Thank you for listening.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba. And hosted by Wonder.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's d2l.org.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.